I'm Dean Newland, and welcome to the Business of Intuition, where I coach, facilitate, train, and speak on the hard science and meaningful experience of intuitive leadership in business, so you can make better decisions, forge real connections, and creatively solve problems to amplify your impact and simplify your life. Welcome to the Business of Intuition.
Just over a year ago, I started the Business of Intuition podcast and have been absolutely delighted by the people who have shown up and who have wanted to be interviewed. I've interviewed nationally known artists and authors, coaches and CEOs, veterinarians, scientists, and even Kempo Karate masters. And all of them have told their own story about how they have guided their lives, their success in business, their development of their teams by using this very well known but not quite understood thing called intuition. And I've made it my focus over the last year to try to bring intuition out of the closet and into the boardroom. And people have been asking me, Dean, once in a while, it'd be nice if you could share your own thoughts on what you've learned over the last year or even over the last 30 years. And so this is a podcast that's really about me sharing some of the insights that I have gained from other people. And instead of being the person who's doing the interviewing, I'm just going to riff for about 25 or 30 minutes. There's two things I really think that have been on top of people's minds. One is, how will our companies be different as we come back to our workplaces as a result of being in lockdown and in social distancing for the last 10, 15 months? What will we find when we come back to work? And then the other thing that I have people been asking a lot of, which is, what sort of leadership is going to be needed in this new environment? So starting off with this first question about, you know, what will we find when we come back to work? I think there are three things. One is the obvious, that we're going to have a blended workforce, that people are going to have to figure out a way to be able to blend working from home as well as working from work. A lot of us, however, have kids who are now enrolled in school, and we don't have plans for daycare as we start to come back to work, as we start to having to make those commutes back into headquarters. And so that's going to cause a real issue for some people. We're also going to have much more open conversations in ways we never did before. You know, I remember there was always this division between work and home. And that's why we even had this phrase called work-life balance. And somehow we were supposed to figure out a way to balance the two because they were separate. Well, now with the advent of us coming back into this blended workforce, working from home and working from work is really all the same thing. That our meetings that we have at work are going to have some sort of focus that is similar to the kinds of focus we need at work. That now issues that we have with childcare and commuting and technology at home are now open for discussion in ways that they never were before. We really are going to have to start asking our employees who are returning to work, what's going on with you at home and how can we accommodate? Because now home is part of where work is happening. And that is going to be a difficult conversation because we're just not used to it. We have this feeling that what I do with my family is none of my boss's business and vice versa. But because we are blending all of these different modalities of work, we got to bring it together into a conversation. So this whole idea around psychological safety is going to be extremely important as people start to come back to some form of work at the quote unquote workplace. However, the problem we also run into is that psychological safety is difficult enough in any day, but when you add the situation of having to have relatively sensitive and vulnerable conversations over Zoom or Microsoft Teams or WebEx, it takes away some of that personal touch. We're going to need to find ways to cut through the technology that's preventing us from having these safe and open conversations so that people can, in fact, share what they're not comfortable sharing. And that's just going to have to change the ethic. I think that's going to be something we're going to have to really get focused on. With a blended workforce, there are, I know in many of the organizations we're dealing with, they're creating task forces and teams and committees to really talk about the whole function of how do we do both work from home and work from work? And what does that look like? And how do we schedule people? And if we no longer have the office that I had before, then who gets it when I'm not there? And do we sign up for office space much like you would going to a hotel? Or do we find that we're no longer going to have pictures of my family on the wall because it's now the wall of my teammate? These are some very complicated things that we're going to have to work out, all the while that we have to continue to move our businesses forward. The other thing that I think we're going to find as we come back to work is this, a new challenge around managing ourselves in meetings. Now, meetings are often for those the bane of existence. There are books out there called Death by Meeting by Patrick Lencioni. We know that meetings are an incredibly important part of business, but if they're run poorly, they become a very ineffective way of getting people together. There are research papers that talk about a guy, for example, a guy named Vogelberg out of South Carolina, who is pretty much the preeminent researcher on meeting and meeting management from a very much of a scientific perspective, says that people essentially, when they value a meeting at a certain amount, they value their work at the same amount. Another way of saying that is that if you increase the value of how people perceive meetings to be, you also find that job satisfaction also goes up. And so it's almost like the water rising all boats, right? And that's where we find that even before the COVID-19 pandemic, meetings were an incredibly costly and yet hidden expense. I know that every year, somewhere around October or September, people sit down and start talking about the budget for the next coming year. Where can we cut? Where can we invest? But we never really sit down and talk about how do we become more effective and productive by how we run, facilitate, plan, and follow up on our meetings. And there's some statistics out there that I found that 50% of all meetings are not necessary, or at least are not being seen as valuable. We even a while back tried to create a tool, which never really got off the ground, called the Meeting Productivity Calculator, which was in a sense this tool that helped people see the actual dollars and cents spent by getting people into a meeting based on their overall annual revenue and bonuses, et cetera, et cetera. And when you start putting dollars and cents to the amount that we spend putting people in meetings, all of a sudden people start to wake up and go, wow, this is a huge expense. And if 50% on average of meetings are not valuable or not seen as even being necessary, think about how much money we're wasting in our companies. So I say that as a backdrop, because as we come back from this period of time of working from home, meetings are going to be something that we will have to really get a handle on. Now, how do we run a meeting when, say, three quarters or half or two people are zooming in where the rest of the people are actually there in an actual physical space? What is the meeting protocol? How do we make sure that those people who are virtually connecting don't become, in a sense, second-class citizens because we can't see them? And that's already the case when you find that certain personality styles, those that are more gregarious, for example, usually dominate meetings, even if they are conscious of it. Now you add on top of that this technological constraint, which is going to make meetings all the more difficult. There's a lot of ideas going out there right now. One of them that I've heard is that you would have all meetings through a Zoom session, even if you are in a face-to-face situation. And then you would just turn, I guess, maybe the volume off if you are in the meeting itself face-to-face. And that those who would be coming in, at least all of us, would see each other like we would in a normal situation. Well, if that makes sense. I guess what I'm trying to say is that might help us stay neutral with our conversations with those who are coming in virtually, but it also decreases the ability for those who are in the room face-to-face to have those kind of deep, meaningful, intimate conversations. So you gain in one area, but then you lose in another. So I think this is going to be probably one of the more difficult and interesting kinds of situations we're going to have to deal with as we come back into a work environment where we have a blended situation. And so that's number two. And I think number three is that that will be different when we come back to work is burnout, fear, and hope. One way we would say is that people are still feeling weary from a very difficult year to year and a half. You have, as this particular podcast was being taped, you still have states who are decreasing their numbers, causing people to feel somewhat hopeful, and others who are increasing their numbers feeling the sense of fear. And there is this kind of a roller coaster going up and down with the way people are responding to this whole COVID-19 pandemic and how we are reporting out on the numbers of people who are affected. And so we have to take into account that a lot of us, some of us more than others, are kind of tired. We're pretty burned out by what's happened. And we are also sort of dualistically hopeful and afraid at the same time. We want to get back to something that feels more normal. Take the going to restaurants and going on vacations aside, but something that feels more normal, being able to connect with our colleagues and our friends at work, that feels like what we used to have before. And we're looking forward to that. But at the same time, we're also afraid. Some people are afraid of being around others who are, in any sort of social situation for obvious reasons. And so there's this sort of push me, pull you. Yes, I want to see these people, but I also am afraid to, you know, how do we do this with social distancing? And yet, how do we have these deep conversations? You know, I was just doing a facilitation a couple of weeks ago with a group of people and their board, and it was all face-to-face. You know, of course, we had the social distancing that went on. And I got to tell you, it was absolutely just the word. It was delicious being able to work with people again in a real-time environment. There is going to be and should be continued evolution and innovation around technology. And I think that's bound to happen. We're going to see more companies trying to crack this nut around virtual teaming and meetings and so forth. But in the end, there is nothing like having face-to-face conversations. And my hope is that we will find a way to bring people back in a way that allows that kind of nothing else, very unique situation that is face-to-face. I think it's imperative for trust and for developing a kind of a culture whereby one can really rely on each other and build lasting and innovative relationships. So this idea about burnout and fear and hope is going to be, I think, on the minds of a lot of people as they come back to work. So number two, the other thing that people are asking, at least me, is, you know, so Dean, if this is the case, you know, this is what we're going to see as companies come back to work, then what kind of a leader needs to evolve in this new environment? And there is a few thoughts that I have on this. Backdrop, as I mentioned before, there's this fear and this burnout that's been going on for quite some time. And a lot of us has been feeling helpless to our situation, afraid. And there is obviously a debate about just how afraid we should be. But in the end, we have had a sort of historic, a pervasive worldwide shot of fear in all of our veins, so to speak. And there is a very dangerous kind of downstream effect that would be created by this if we don't get a handle on it. There is fear, and then there is being able to boldly move forward even when you are afraid. What I'm noticing is that there is an increase of timidity. There is an increase of people playing it safe. There is an increase, and I dare say it, somewhat over-exaggeration around one's own safety in some cases. And I have to be careful because I don't want to go down a political or a decisive type of conversation here, but it is all over the board about how people are responding to this time. And so therefore, if that's what we're smelling and breathing in the air, then we will eventually be affected by it. And so my hope is that as we come back to work, we can certainly express and feel our fear, no matter what it is. But at the same time, let's not let the fear dominate how we make decisions. Let's be afraid, and yet let's talk about it. Let's build relationship around our common fear. Let's don't be isolated in that. But then at the same time, let's also find a way to be bold in our forward thinking. And I'd like to sort of suggest a word that will have many meanings to people, but I'll explain it here in a second. I think we need more heroic leadership. So let me tell you why I mean that. And it's not the right exact word, because words these days have so many different connotations and meanings, but let me try to give you my interpretation of that. Hero, not in the sense of warlike or predominantly male or dominating over any one person or group. It's not about that. It's about being able to lead and also find a vision that you can put your attention to. It's doing the right thing. It is even in the face of adversity and people pushing back, that you still will find a direction to move forward on. I watched a really fascinating presentation just about a year ago, and I will try to find the name of this person and maybe include it in the show notes, that was talking about a certain kind of leadership. And she broke it up into two pieces. One was Hercules or Herculean leadership, and another was Buddha leadership. And I thought this was really quite interesting, because what she said is that we need to have Buddha leadership. And Buddha leadership is really that kind of leader that is a great listener and a great coach and mentor. And we encourage people to participate, and we allow them, and we want to bring them into the key decisions of the company. And we want psychological safety, good emotional intelligence, you know, all of the things that create the space for people to say, yes, I want to participate, I want to engage, count me in. You've created a house that looks delicious and wonderful and safe and inviting. I want to walk into this house, you know, that sort of Buddha leadership, if you will. And I really believe that we need that. It's been probably the throughput of my entire career has been around that kind of work. That's why I got involved in coaching in the first place, was not to dominate, not to tell people what to do, but to help them uncover their own answers, to listen, to be present, to have people tap into their own inner voice, their intuition, if you will. I so deeply believe that is an important part of what we all need to get better at doing. At the same time, what she says is that we also have to have a Herculean hat that we play as leaders. And that is the side that says there's going to be one or two, maybe three things that I will certainly collect input on, but I am unwavering in my decision to move forward. And it could be things like, it could be finance, it could be the kind of culture you want to create. It is a vision for the future. You put your own answer into that question, but it's a focus and it's a non-negotiable kind of a perspective about how we should boldly do something that's correct, that sometimes maybe not always be popular. Her point was, have a couple of things that are your Herculean type of leadership, focused on a couple of things that you are very, very clear and you are consistent in, meaning that I always want to make sure that you realize that this is something that is non-negotiable, and I always want you to understand that this is not always up for debate. This is consistent. Because what happens sometimes, as you guys know, is that we might be very firm and clear and directive in one way, one day, and then that same topic becomes something that we open up for consensus the next day. And what it ends up doing is it causes confusion for people. Is this person really focused on this area, or is this something that will change based on the mood or the flavor of the day? So I thought that was a pretty interesting perspective. And so I take this sort of heroic idea, this Buddha and the Herculean leadership idea, to say that this is a time that we need people to see the vision of the future. We need to be able to show and describe a vision that is not quarter to quarter or even the end of the year or even the end of the next 2 years, but think beyond that. Think 2040. Think 2050. And what does that look like? And so this sort of, call it heroic leadership, call it Herculean leadership, it will also encourage people to engage at the same time. In a time of great stress, we need people to engage us, but we also need people to say, where are we going? What does this look like? How are we going to get there? And that's part of what I think we have lost a little bit over the last couple of years, maybe more, that we have created such an environment and a focus around engagement that we've lost what it means to be a leader around direction and a focus on the future. Again, I can't overstate this much, how much important it is to be that Buddha leader, to be that person who creates that space. I'm just saying that we also need leaders who will step up, make the tough choices, and be able to help us see a future. It's a leader who says, I will hire not only for skill, but I will hire for culture. And if for some reason the person, no matter how much we work with them, coach them, mentor them, that they're not a fit to the culture, that we will find them another position or we will move them out of the organization. The leader who, you know, sets that kind of precedent, a leader who actually says our guiding principles not only are good for our annual board meeting, but they really mean something. We bring this into our succession planning. We hold people accountable to those things. This is what our culture needs to be now in the future. And if people will play and engage in that new culture, then let's do it. But if not, let's not keep a bunch of dead weight that's going to hold us all back. I think that's important. So that's one of the things I think that when we come out of this, hopefully this coming out of this COVID situation, that a few of us will have the courage to be heroic, to be able to set a vision for the future. Part of what it means to setting a vision for the future, I think, is another topic I want to talk about, which is training people to be innovative thinkers. Not just simply say, give us your great ideas, but how do we train people cognitively, socially, culturally, to think outside the box? What does that look like? I think that's really very much important. Because in the end, as we ask people to participate in ideation sessions, what we really find out is that sharing a new idea is an act of vulnerability. It's not easy to do because we are afraid and we're conditioned to interpret that what I say as an idea could be discounted by somebody else because it's not realistic or we don't have a budget for it. So ideation, I think, is really important. This ability to think innovatively is really, really important as we begin to create this vision for the future, to be able to think beyond what is currently our reality. And one of the exercises that I have heard of that I think is great, it comes right out of improv, is something called yes and. So when you're doing an ideation session, you're brainstorming, you'd never in the beginning start to vet the ideas. You just simply add on to the other person's idea. And it's not about quality of idea at the beginning, it's just about the quantity of the ideas. So you would go around a session and you'd ask people to come up with some ideas on whatever topic. But the exercise is to say, yes, and you would fill in whatever your idea is. So you get this immediate positive feedback that you've been acknowledged by the yes of the other person. And then they get a chance to build on top of that. Such a simple thing, but it can make a huge difference in how you do ideation sessions and brainstorming sessions. And there's a lot of different innovation strategies that we've developed and what we've sort of taken from others that we're using right now in some programs. But this idea of yes and, I think, is really great when it comes to helping people produce ideas when we are sort of socialized not to, because by creating an idea, there's always that risk. But what if somebody doesn't like it? What if it's the wrong idea? What if it's not something that is fact-based? You know, we've got organizations out there that have as their guiding principle that we make decisions based on facts and science. Well, that's certainly appropriate for many, many things. But when it comes to ideation, when it comes to innovation, when it comes to thinking outside the box, that kills ideas. What we want to do in those situations is to allow people to, if I go back to the name of this podcast, use their intuition to come up with ideas, is to get out of that cognitive part of the brain, that prefrontal cortex that is constantly judging, and go into something more playful, more childlike, that allows us to think differently, because we experience life based on how we think. And so if we want to experience life differently, we will need to think differently. And this idea around yes and is one that I think is important. Another idea around like what is different or should be different as we enter back into our corporate offices and what does that mean for leadership is, it makes me think about Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey. And I would definitely, if you haven't done any research on him, fantastic social scientist and expert in myths and religion and culture. He had a very famous series by Bill Moyers years and years and years ago. You can probably find it on YouTube, or I know that even Facebook has a group that's just around his work. But this idea that the hero's journey describes a model that says that human beings transform in very similar ways, no matter whether it's 100 or 200 years ago or whether it's right now, that this transformation has some telltale signs that can be replicated, that if we can understand religion and culture and Shakespeare and art and movies even, and understand how do people transform, then if we understand that process, maybe we then can adapt to it ourselves as leaders and members of organizations. One of the key things about the hero's journey is this notion of getting the call. And Hollywood has used Campbell's model of the hero's journey many times. Star Wars is a model, is a movie. All of them are based on the hero's journey. The Matrix, have you ever watched that? That is based on the hero's journey. There is Greek mythology is based on the hero's journey. But this idea of getting the call, where the hero or heroine, male, female, doesn't matter which one, gets a call to step up and to transform, to do something for themselves or the community or their family. And it's nothing that they expect. It's not like you wake up one morning and go, well, I'm going to metaphorically change myself, because change is often not something that we make happen. It's something that we are asked to make happen. If we were just left to our own devices, and based on what I know of neuroscience, we would stay the same pretty much the whole time, because there's no energy to stay the same. It's usually an external force, a person or a situation, that calls us into action. And that's what Joseph Campbell talks about in The Hero's Journey, is this idea that we are being called to transform. You know, in The Matrix, Neo, if you may remember that movie, gets a literal phone call that asks him to connect with what becomes his mentor, Morpheus. And the same sort of pattern we find over and over and over again. People talk about when they were kids, or when we have a leader is working with a member of their team, we sometimes find that call to action, that you are now being asked to take on this new role or this new project, and I'm going to be your mentor to work through that. These situations don't always come because we are asking for them, but because they are presented to us and we decide, yes, I will take this on. And so I believe that there is a call to action for a lot of us right now to step up in our leadership during this very difficult and interesting time that we are in, if we have the courage to do that, if we have the courage to pay attention to the subtle voice that says, it's now time. It's now time for you to lead. It's now time for you to create a vision, not just to survive 2021, but to thrive, to create a vision that goes beyond this year or next year, but maybe even to the next decade. What does that look like? We have gotten, I think, out of practice with dreaming, and we need to build up that muscle again. And we need to do it with maybe other people and friends and family, with coworkers, but let's get past the habit of just taking care of day-to-day business and start getting into a new habit around planning and envisioning the future. Just as strategic planning in organizations is a ritual that needs to happen, if it's going to happen, it has to be scheduled, right? Your values show up in your calendar, right? What you value is what you schedule. If we value ideation, we value this idea of thinking beyond where we are right now, then let's schedule it. Let's put in time with people to do that. And I, quite frankly, I think that there is no better way to do that kind of ideation work, but then to do it face-to-face. Not to say it can't happen. I actually facilitated sort of an ideation session between two companies in two different time zones over a period of several days. It went really well. People really thought it was well done, given the situation at hand, you know, the limited technology that we had. But nonetheless, there's nothing like being able to get face-to-face. The other thing about the idea around leadership and its new requirements moving forward based on COVID-19, some of it is not new, but some of it just becomes that more important. Again, as we work on engaging people in psychological safety, safe areas, and we start to hold a vision for the future, and we have hopefully some sort of assessment to be able to say, these are our leadership competencies, and this is how we are creating our company's culture and how we will hold you accountable to those leadership competencies. The idea around accountability, I think, is another one of those things to call out. And it's a tough one, because I have to say, nobody loves difficult conversations. And yet accountability by somebody else can help us grow our own leadership and make us better people. The things that have happened to me when people had a high set of standards and I was able to meet those standards, I grew a lot because of that. I had writing teachers and acting teachers, and I had mentors in business who expected a lot from me, and clients who expected a lot from me, who held me accountable to that. And if I didn't perform, I may lose the gig. Those things helped me grow, you know? So on one hand, accountability is very much a bar for us to reach for, you know? It can help transform performance. On the other hand, we don't like to hold people accountable because it's akin to conflict. Accountability and conflict are almost like Siamese twins. So we can get very good at setting expectations and setting a vision and creating this culture of allowance and letting people to participate and making sure that there's psychological safety, and we give them the coaching and the mentoring, the resources to do the work. And in the end, there will always be some that won't be able to, for whatever reason. And why they can't live up to those principles or those expectations is really not that important for this argument. I'm just saying that there's all sorts of different reasons. But the point is, do we lower our standard to allow for those to participate because it's lower than our current standard? Or do we say we have to hold to our standards? And if after everything is being said and done, we can't see the change in you to perform, then the accountability comes in on a more of a crucial conversations basis. We need to, at that point, sit down with people and go through your normal performance management process. Boy, I don't know, but at this now, I just realized I was talking to some friends over the weekend that this, I think it's this July, is our 30th year. Man, it amazes me how quickly time flies. And accountability and conflict are one of those very important and often very difficult things to achieve. And there's so many positive things can happen when we are good at holding people accountable in a respectful way that obviously is within our values. At the same time, there are so many downstream effects that we find when people don't hold people accountable and don't have those crucial conversations. It becomes the elephant in the room. It is like the alcoholic father, if you will, who everybody now starts to work around and to enable just to survive. You know, when we have a culture of not having the ability to hold people accountable, because essentially what it says is that those of you who are doing the hard work and making things happen, it sends a message that says, we don't value you as much because we allow this person to stay on the team who is not performing well. So I think accountability and crucial conversations is one of those things that's something that we really need to get really good at. And it's hard because as we're coming back from this really difficult time, we want this to be about inclusion and engagement and nurturing and psychological safety. And we're giving people mulligans, if you will, and we're giving people a lot of leeway to get past this time. And at the same time, if we're going to have the kind of companies that will survive and thrive long into the next 2 or 3 decades, we'll have to set some strong strong visions. We'll have to engage people in that. And there'll have to be some sort of accountability that will ensure that that happens. So as I finish up here, I just wanted to reiterate a couple of things. When we come back to work, things will not be the way they were. When we come back to work, we as leaders will need to get better at some old things and adapt some new things. We will need to work on this whole idea of a blended workforce. How do we manage meetings? How do we take care of people's burnout and fear and get those sparks of hope really lit? How do we then be both the Buddha and the hero, the Buddha and the Hercules when it comes to leadership? How do we then allow ourselves to take on the task of being bold leaders who engage? These are not mutually exclusive. To bring people together on a focus that goes beyond our current status. To bring people together that says the future looks good, let's create it together. And let's envision that and then work our way backwards from that versus the other way around. Continue to work on engaging people at the same time, knowing that engagement without accountability is mediocrity. So thank you very much for allowing me to riff for the last 30 or so minutes. I hope you found it useful, and I look forward to further discussions with fantastic guests coming up here in year 2.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Intuition. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Dean or Mission Facilitators Leadership, go to mfileadership.com. That's mfileadership.com.